You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from the co-creator of a podcast that set out to discover who created Milwaukee's first hip-hop song. First, how often do you go into a store and pay with cash? A 2017 survey shows that half the people say they carry cash less than 50% of the time, and when they do, most say they have less than 50 bucks in their pocket. And 46% say they use cash less than 8 days a month. The financial advice website NerdWallet says that because of widespread credit and debit card use, as well as apps that let you digitally transfer money, cash is not used nearly as often. Some businesses around the country, including a very small number here in Wisconsin, have responded by jumping on the digital train and doing away with cash altogether. So where does that leave those who still prefer paper money? Well, there's a bill in the state legislature that would force brick-and-mortar shops to accept cash payments. Gary Tauchin is the author of that proposal. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 6th Assembly District, which includes parts of Outagamie, Brown, Waupaca, and Shawano counties. Representative Tauchin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the overview. What will your bill do?
Okay, I have a Wisconsin cash option bill, and it's AB 364. It's been referred to the Small Business Committee. I think people have a misconception that businesses must utilize cash payment for different services and purchases that they make. And there is no federal requirement to accept cash as legal tender. However, there is no federal prohibition on states imposing that option for customers. And I'm 65 years old, so we have an aging population, and people that are concerned with credit fraud, people that don't have credit cards or debit cards, and then people that have lower credit scores and are simply lacking credit altogether. So I'm introducing this cash option bill to protect Wisconsin consumers, and that the bill itself requires that retailers provide a cash option for purchases. So basically, it's freedom of choice. It gives consumers the options that they want.
And there is certainly a movement towards more and more electronic payment. But what are some of the reasons, besides you mentioned, you know, things like perhaps having bad credit, things like that, what are some of the reasons why some people really prefer using cash?
Well, I use everything, but there are 15.2% of Wisconsin, there was a survey done, and there were 15.2% of Wisconsin residents who had no credit cards. And there's a lot of people that are in the lower income bracket that like to pay with cash. They're four times more likely to pay with cash than people who are in the upper income tax bracket. So I think one of the other things is that technology is great when it works. We have problems with computers crashing. We've got, you know, expensive cell phones. We have problems with credit cards and debit cards having their numbers stolen. So there's a lot of checks and balances need to be in place, but I think at least my generation grew up with cash and different opportunities. Information technology really has taken off the last 20 or 25 years, but before that, we didn't have the options, different options. And so I think there's a movement in certain areas of the country recognizing that this situation just isn't as black and white as it can be. In Philadelphia, they became the first major city to require that businesses accept cash for payment. San Francisco just approved legislation that bans cashless brick-and-mortar stores. New Jersey has passed a law that forces most shops to accept cash, and New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. are looking at cashless bans. So it's becoming one of those issues that is cropping up around the country.
We're talking with Gary Tauchin right now. He is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 6th Assembly District. That includes Outagamie, Brown, Waupaca, and Shawano counties. And Representative Tauchin, we asked our listeners about this over on Facebook, and Deb wrote, if you don't like it, don't shop there. If they don't have enough business, they will change or close. Let the market decide. We also heard from Michael. He writes, a store should have the right to decide in which manner they accept payments. Many coffee shops and craft breweries do not accept cash. They like it that way. It makes recording easier, and it's harder for workers to steal from them. If a store wishes to only deal in cash, that's their right too, though they might be missing out on customers that do not use cash, or I think he meant actually that do not use electronic forms of payment. So I guess the question that both of them are raising is, why not let businesses decide for themselves what payments to accept and then kind of take the consequences?
There's a process that we need to go through, and there's differences of opinion on both sides of it. And so we have, I mentioned earlier that this bill is in the Small Business Committee. And so we have hearings where those who support and oppose the bill, those who have ideas on how to make it better, can propose amendments. And so we'll go through the whole process of having a public hearing and an executive hearing and getting as much input as we can, because there is no perfect bill, and we just want to give people opportunities. If you're looking at it from the standpoint of the businesses, yes, those are valid arguments. If you're looking at it from the standpoint of the consumer and giving them the opportunity to have different options, then it's a little different ballgame. So we need to, the bill itself probably needs to be refined, and we'll go through the process and try to do that.
Do you have a sense of what percentage, or just kind of a ballpark idea of how many businesses in Wisconsin right now do not accept cash?
I don't. I know that some businesses in they're doing a trial down at the Milwaukee Bucks Arena. Some of the businesses, I think 11 of the 60 vendors they have there are cashless. So they're doing a trial. They're going to evaluate it over the course of the next year and look at the advantages, the disadvantages, and the opportunities that might be there. So I think, I'm not sure how many actually do that, but there's businesses that are trying to figure out what might work best in their situations.
Representative Tauchin, this bill would require businesses in Wisconsin to accept cash as a form of payment. Under the bill, as it's currently written, what would happen if a business is found to still be refusing to take cash?
Well, there's penalties, because if you don't have a penalty in place, then it can be ignored. But if they decide that they're not happy with it and want to do that, then there's a forfeiture to the state of not less than $200 and not more than $500 for a violation of this proposal.
And what have you been hearing from either business owners in the state or from consumers?
Well, I think we're getting emails and phone calls both ways. Those who support it think it's a great idea, that we ought to be able to have the option as consumers. And, of course, then businesses that deal in electronics would rather see it the other way. So there may be a middle ground and some compromise, but at least we've got the discussion going, because the world's changed a lot in the last 20 or 25 years.
And before we let you go, what are the next steps, and when would this bill possibly be getting voted on in the legislature and possibly making it to the governor's desk?
Well, the process is long, and we're at the beginning. And so it goes to the Small Business Committee. That committee needs to hear the bill. We need to go to public hearing and move forward from there. So it's going to be a long process, and at least we have the discussion going.
Well, Representative Tauchin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Gary Tauchin is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 6th Assembly District. We talked with him about his bill that would require brick-and-mortar stores in Wisconsin to accept cash payments. Many of you have commented on cashless stores on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can keep the conversation going by letting us know what you think. Again, that's Ideas Network on Facebook. Coming up, we learn about the key to love and what it has to do with Milwaukee's first hip-hop song. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. According to the heads of America's biggest companies, corporations should exist not just to benefit shareholders. They should also help their employees, protect the environment, and treat suppliers ethically. Coming up, we'll look at how people have viewed corporations in the past and what it may take to improve those perceptions. First, hip-hop has become one of, if not the biggest, music genre in the world. And to put a local spin on hip-hop's history, do you know what the first hip-hop song made in Milwaukee was? Well, that question was so inspiring to our next guest, he made a podcast to answer it. Justin Barney is the music director of Radio Milwaukee, and he joins us now from their studio. Justin, good to have you back.
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, Justin, why was answering this question about who made the first Milwaukee hip-hop song so interesting to you?
I just thought that it was a real interesting idea. I had this conversation with this guy, Andy Noble, who is a record collector here in Milwaukee. And we were just talking at this cafe, and he dropped this line on me, and he said that there was this band that kind of accidentally made Milwaukee's first hip-hop song. And I was like, what a weird thing. What a weird idea. And so then I kind of like put it on the board and was like, because hip-hop is an entire genre. And before it, there was R&B, there was disco, there was the things that influenced it. And then there was hip-hop, and we've had it ever since. And so the idea that there was a first song, that there had to be someone who recorded the very first one, intrigued me. And this guy knew it, or kind of thought that he knew it. And so we had a discussion on who really recorded it, what it was, and we dug into what is Milwaukee's first hip-hop song.
And we should mention that you co-host this podcast, which is called Backspin. You go on this journey with a DJ from Radio Milwaukee, Tyrone Miller. Here's a clip of him explaining his ties to hip-hop culture in the city and getting involved with answering this big central question.
I've known so many of what I think are the originators or the people that started Milwaukee hip-hop, whether they were the DJs, the MCs, the people on the radio. And I've worked with them in so many different capacities, so much respect for them. And we've never talked about that. I know maybe when they started DJing or when they started rapping just casually, but nobody has ever asked that question. Nobody has ever told me just straight up, yeah, I was the one. I did it. And we'll see who actually did.
So, Justin, you go off on this quest. You start talking to experts and people who are part of the music scene in Milwaukee over the last several decades. And you learn about a musician and entrepreneur, Marvell Love, who's an early character in this story. Tell us about Marvell Love.
Marvell Love is like my favorite character in this whole thing. So there was like, so hip hop became a thing in New York. And this was a thing that, so hip hop spread throughout the country and it had to come to Milwaukee. And this is, you know, pre-internet. So it's coming by the way that it comes. And Marvell Love he owned a record label in Milwaukee. He wanted to make Milwaukee like the Motown of the Midwest or of, you know, of Wisconsin. And so he started this record label called New World Records. And Marvell Love, he's kind of like the businessman with the business plan. I think of him as this kind of like outsized record executive kind of character. And he wanted to find the group to record the first hip-hop song because he went to a conference. He went to a music conference that said hip-hop is the next big thing. And so, you know, he takes it back to Milwaukee and he was like, hip-hop's going to be the next big thing. I have to be the one to record it because we can make money here. We can be part of the next big thing. And so then what he does in the early 80s, in 1981, is he finds this band, The Majestics. And The Majestics were this funk band. They were not a hip-hop band, have zero interest in making hip-hop music, don't know what it is. And he says to them, you know, you need to make a hip-hop song. And they're hustlers. They still make music. They still make funk music. They're playing, you know, they played last week in Milwaukee as this funk group. And he told them, you got to make this hip-hop song. And so they make a hip-hop song. Well, they make this song called Class A.
Well, first, let's hear a little bit about the Majestics before they kind of got told, you know, you've got to do hip hop. Let's hear a little from this song.
The key to love is understanding. The key to love.
Yeah, not very hip hoppy.
Not very hip hoppy at all. And that is the song that's on the other side of the 45 that is Milwaukee's first hip-hop song. So that lets you know that this is not a hip-hop group, that the Majestics, they made songs like that, The Key to Love. And that's this great kind of soul ballad. And they were entertainers in the style of like James Brown. And that is what they sought to do, was to entertain and to make R&B music, like that song, The Key to Love. And then on the other side of that record is technically Milwaukee's first hip-hop song, The Key to the Class A.
Well, and let's listen to a little bit of Class A. You know, maybe different sides of the album, maybe it sounds different. Let's take a listen.
Do it.
This is the groove for the year. We're coming at you loud and clear. Our sounds are strong, our funk is too. We play our song just for you. We are down and for real.
Okay, so our board op, Sarah and I are kind of grooving over here. Like you said, you know, very, very James Brown kind of sound. Again, not what I would think hip hop.
Right. That's early hip hop. When I was talking to Andy Noble, who is the record label, he's the record collector now. You know, he would describe that as disco rap. That's kind of like the very early style of rap, like Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight, a hip hop. You know, it's got that. It's very much like almost a disco song, just with a bit of a different vocal delivery. And so they released that song in 1981, and it did basically nothing. You know, it was just a blip on the radar. And I went in wanting to tell this story about that song because I thought that it lived on this island kind of before anyone else. And it was this thing that was kind of ahead of its time, though, it's not the greatest hip hop song in the world. And then Tyrone, my co-host, was like, well, we got to talk to all these guys that were in the Milwaukee scene. We got to talk to Mike Love. We got to talk to DMC. We got to talk to Too Tough Tony. And we went to them and we were like, you know, let's talk about this song, Class A by the Majestics. And they all said, what song? Class A by the Majestics? We don't know that song. We don't, like, that song wasn't important to anyone. And they kept on bringing up Peachy, a.k.a. Todd Thomas, a.k.a. Speech. And they all independently were like, this is the guy that did it. This is the one that matters. And so, kind of like in the middle of our journey, it kind of went from being like, yeah, 001, Class A is technically the first song, but does that mean that it is the most important, or does that mean that it's like the first one, though it was technically the first one?
Justin Barney's the music director for Radio Milwaukee, and we're talking about his podcast, Backspin, that traces the history of Milwaukee's first hip-hop song. And Justin, you just mentioned Speech and the song Attack. Let's listen to some of that.
Music is chromatic, it's a drop without static. Phenomenal indeed, and that's emphatic. The rhymes give us all the night kind of a nine. Put appropriate in battle whenever it's time, you know.
Excuse me, Peachy. May I? May you what? May I get on the turntable?
All right, so when did Speech make that song?
Right, so this is 1984-85. This is kind of in the middle of the 80s that lived like several years after Class A. And you can hear that in the production style, it's different from Class A by the Majestics. They had like a live band doing this recording, and that song by Attack, the song is called Attack on the Wax, that is done with a different production style entirely. And we got the whole team, everyone said that this is the song that matters, and that, you know, what matters in hip hop and in a culture is not the first song. Like Sugar Hill Gang is not the first rap song. But it was the first rap song that had a big impact across the culture of hip-hop. And they got back to us and said, you know, hip-hop is not just about, you know, you nerd looking at the paper saying this is 001. This is the first song on a label, that it's about this whole culture. And this, and Attack on the Wax is what impacted the culture of music in Milwaukee. And it spawned all of these great, this great scene, these guys that are still making music. And it had this impact that was kind of greater than itself, in a way that Class A did not have.
Well, Justin, it sounds like a really fun project to work on, and it's a really fun podcast to listen to. Thanks so much for giving us some of the story.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Justin Barty, music director of Radio Milwaukee. We talked with him about his podcast, Backspin. It traces the history of Milwaukee's first hip-hop song, and you can hear the whole podcast by going to radiomilwaukee.org/backspin. Coming up, we'll talk about the purpose of corporations, then, now, and in the future. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, by 2030, about 1 in every 10 Wisconsinites will be in their 70s. Host Keely Boltina is joined by a doctor who shares advice and answers your questions about healthy living in your 70s. That's tomorrow morning at 7, here on the Ideas Network. Now the heads of some of America's biggest companies are rethinking corporations' role in society. 181 CEOs from the Business Roundtable Lobbying Group issued a statement on Monday. It says it will no longer put shareholders first. Instead, the group says the goal will be to put employees, the environment, and general society on the same level as stockholders. The move comes during a time of increasing frustration towards corporate America over income inequality, harmful products, political influence, and poor working conditions. So what would this revised definition of the purpose of a corporation look like in practice? Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School and author of Forged in Crisis: The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, good to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure, Judith.
First off, let's start with a really basic question. What exactly makes a business a corporation?
A corporation is a legal structure that is an organizing concept in which the entity, right, is owned collectively by shareholders. It needn't be a public corporation, that is, a company that floats its stock on the public markets. You can have private corporations, but corporation is a legal entity that, defined primarily by the means and structure of ownership of that company.
And for at least the past 50 years or so, the role of corporations was pretty clearly thought to maximize profit for those shareholders. Tell us about that idea and how we saw that in real life.
So for much of the 20th century, I'm a historian, so just to back the tape up very briefly, for much of the 20th century, say well into the 1970s, the unstated and at times articulated goal or purpose or objective of a public corporation was of course to deliver value to the owners of a public corporation, which are its shareholders, but it also included this largely unstated but nonetheless very well understood social contract, which had to do with, you know, often long-term employment for its workers, a sense of rootedness in communities. This was an age when a lot of American business was still primarily based in America, and the obligations that go with that rootedness, a sense of responsibility for and mutually beneficial obligations to its suppliers, the other businesses with which it made its commerce. And all of that began to change, that sense of broad-based obligations and priorities for public corporations began to change in largely unarticulated ways in, say, the late 1970s, early 1980s, gaining a great deal of speed in the 1990s, partly as a result of the increasing globalization of business, partly as a result of a set of academic work that came out that said, if you have people in control of companies that own the companies as opposed to managers who didn't have stock in the companies, you would get better outcomes for the companies. And partly as a result of what a series of people inside and outside business have called the financialization of the American economy, in which all kinds of organizations that dealt in lending markets and different kinds of financial markets became much, much more important. And Wall Street became much more important. And all those different threads emerged with help from people like Milton Friedman, who had said a long time ago, the University of Chicago economist, that the purpose of a public corporation is to maximize profit for its shareholders. All those different threads in the way that history is made resulted in this unquestioned and yet, you know, very, very firmly adhered to idea that the purpose of any public business is to maximize value for shareholders, implicitly elevating and then explicitly elevating the shareholder above the employee, above the community, above political, you know, contribution in the sense of, you know, how do we do our business, above the environment, above their vendors or suppliers. And so we have arrived at a point where now a number of different very prominent CEOs are saying on paper that that needs to change, that unquestioned adherence to maximizing value for shareholders needs to change and make way for a broader set of obligations that look reminiscent of the company that our parents or grandparents grew up with.
We're talking with Nancy, Harvard Business School, and we're talking about a new initiative by a group called the Business Roundtable to say that making profit isn't the most important thing that corporations should be focusing on. They should be focusing on things like impact on the environment, how they treat their employees, and so on. And Nancy, tell us a little more about this group, the Business Roundtable. Who is part of that?
So the Business Roundtable is a trade organization, and it is also a lobbying organization. And so it has, again, for many years stated without equivocation that the purpose of the public corporation or of a corporation that it is to maximize value for shareholders and that shareholders matter more than other folks around the table, so to speak. On Monday, they announced a new statement. Beginning with these words, Americans deserve an economy that allows each person to succeed through hard work and creativity and to lead a life of meaning and dignity. While we believe in the free market system, and now I'm paraphrasing, right, business has an incredibly important role to play in that, and that means that individual companies have to be committed to all of our stakeholders. And so we get a statement about value to customers, employees, suppliers, communities, and shareholders. So they're elevating a bunch of other folks on paper to the same place that where shareholders have lived for a long time. I should say, for the benefit of our listeners, that this is signed by a host, about 30 quite prominent CEOs, from the CEO of American Express to the CEO of American Airlines to the CEO, Jeff Bezos, of Amazon, Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, And Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, who's been a prominent exponent of the fact that we can't go on just trying to value shareholders with no attention to all these other folks. So the Business Roundtable saying this made a great deal of news because they have historically been all about profit maximization for shareholders. Deep breath. What this means in practice, what these companies are actually going to do differently, right, after several years of using tax breaks for businesses, primarily for things like stock buybacks, which lower the number of shares outstanding and make shareholders wealthier by doing that, by contracting the supply of stock, whether these people are actually going to, you know, do something differently, that's where the rubber meets the road, and we don't know the answer to that.
Well, Nancy, corporations have been criticized for quite a while for things like not paying any corporate taxes, for excessive compensation for their executives, for environmental impact. The list goes on and on.
Yep.
Why? And certainly corporations have been aware of that. Why do you think this kind of statement is coming right now?
Yeah, that's really an important question, Judith. I think it has a lot to do with, again, a series of, if you will, wins now with all good reason, with all good justification, buffeting business from, right, these massive discrepancies in what the five or six most important people in a company make to the average worker. Right now, in public corporations in America, the relationship between the median salary of the employees in those corporations and the CEO salary is now 254 times. So a CEO makes 254 times what the median pay is for employees in an organization. That's just crazy. It's destructive. It's terribly unbalanced. It's contributing to economic inequality. I think that's a piece. I think a second piece is the political wins, if you will, and a series of very popular candidates, not just Bernie Sanders, but Elizabeth Warren and other candidates calling for much more aggressive regulation of business. From we got to break up tech, right? We got to break up these tech companies, to we really have to do something about the way the big banks are organized. So there's a huge groundswell of American citizen interest in calling business to account now in a new way. I think the growing political role of business as corporate, as citizens, employees, and all kinds of activists see it. Remember Charlottesville, right, in that terrible moment in American history when a white supremacist action in that city, right, claimed a life and became violent. Right after that, President Trump said there were good people on both sides. That was perceived to be such an incendiary, such an inappropriate, such an unethical remark that Ken Frazier, the CEO of Merck, a large medical device company, stepped off an advisory council to the president, and that led to a whole number of other people stepping off, because these CEOs perceived that their employees and their other stakeholders, right, wouldn't respect them and would call them, again, on the carpet for doing that. So you now have this new, incredibly important force of business now being responsible for what they stand for and how they do it. And I think last, but by no means least, is the extraordinary interest now and the ticking time bomb of the global environment and business's role in that. So you add all those things up, and it simply can't appear to be business as usual anymore. And so I think this statement is coming out in response to those kind of powerful, right, forces from a variety of different groups and individuals.
Something you said, Nancy, I thought was especially interesting. You said that, you know, especially with the candidates who are hoping to be the nominee on the Democratic side, calling for accountability and some restraint on corporations. It kind of reminds me of situations where corporations may be at risk, I will say, from their perspective, of more regulation, and they say, wait, we'll do it ourselves. Promise. Let us handle this.
Cross my heart and hope to die. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, again, that's why I say, you know, these are These are very smart, very, very skilled people politically and in all kinds of other ways, right? Is this, right, in a sense, a group of people saying we've got to go public saying, cross my heart and hope to die, we're going to do things differently and we're not just going to be about shareholder value. By the way, almost all of the people on this list are paid heavily based on how high they can get their stock price, which creates a very, very interesting and I think ultimately destructive conflict of interest, or certainly if you look at the way things have played out in terms of the ratio between executive compensation and everyone else. So they're now trying, I think, right, to forestall something they see coming and to cool, if you will, the pressure on the part of all kinds of folks for significant change in how business does its business. To be very candid, I'm not sure, unless we begin to see where the rubber meets the road and changes pretty quickly in how these different CEOs comport their companies and themselves, I'm not sure this is going to make a great deal of difference.
We're talking right now about the changing purpose of corporations with Nancy Kane. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School and the author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the purpose of corporations? Who or what should they serve primarily? Do you have a generally favorable or unfavorable view of corporations? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about corporations. A memo this week from the Business Roundtable, that's a lobbying group made up of top CEOs, said that corporations should no longer exist to serve only their shareholders. Instead, they should put customers, employees, suppliers, the environment, and communities first. Nancy Kane is our guest. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School and the author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Business Roundtable's new view on the purpose of corporations? Do you believe them? And if you have stock in a company through your retirement fund or another way, would you support a shift like this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to the phones, and Jeff in Oconto is up. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'd like to ask your guests to give an example of companies that are reverting to the type of companies that our parents and grandparents grew up with. I believe that's what I heard her say. And when I think about my grandparents especially, I think of violent anti-union busting companies. And in my parents' time, more not so violent, but still many companies anti-union.
Great. Well, thanks for that call, Jeff. And Nancy, some examples.
Sure. Let me take one that I think most of our listeners will know, or most of your listeners will know of, Whole Foods. So that company was founded, I don't know, 30 years ago by a very contrarian capitalist. He calls himself someone who practices conscious capitalism, named John Mackey. That's a company where almost all of the stock held by employees in most public corporations, this is exactly the reverse, Jeff. But in that company, some 70 or 80% of the stock that's held internally is held by workers that are not senior leaders of the company. And in most companies, it's exactly the reverse. Almost all the public stock in most public corporations is held by the C-suite, by the CEO and the other executive vice presidents of different functions. So Mackey set out to start a company in which everyone would rise. Suppliers would rise, local food producers would rise, in which employees could build a career there and would be paid well. He doesn't like unions, Jeff, to your point, but there's been very little success organizing Whole Foods because people are paid well, they build careers, they get raises, they hold stock, and they have a very, very good reputation along all these kind of metrics like, you know, environmental sustainability, right? Stakeholder relations in communities. So there's a company which Wall Street, like sometimes and other times, hates, that has been very successful building value for all kinds of folks. Let me mention another one, also well known in the same rough space, Starbucks, a company that has really tried to deliver value to its people in all kinds of ways, from healthcare benefits to career development to paying their employees well and providing things like college education for their employees, et cetera. So there's a company, again, Howard Schultz has been an explicit proponent that we can't just be about shareholders and Wall Street. Another company, Costco, right, another retailer, interestingly, where from the very beginnings, from James Sinegal's founding of that company back in, you know, 40 years ago, it has been a company where, again, value has been shared very broadly among those different stakeholders. One last one, Patagonia. I don't know how these all come to be in retail spaces, but Patagonia, the outdoor wear and outdoor equipment manufacturer, where, again, you have, we exist to serve the communities, our customers, our employees, our vendors, the people that we depend on. Right? That definition, which gets to the heart of what the Business Roundtable is saying, whether they do anything about it or not, those are really good, very successful companies, by the way, that have a different view of how you serve the people you serve and what you owe them.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. And on Facebook, we had a few listeners weigh in. Neil writes, look what happened to Ford when he started paying workers $5 a day and they could afford to buy the cars they were making.
Exactly.
Greed is not everything. Larry writes, corporations should be concerned for more than their bottom line, especially since they represent such a large power block, us, the collective national interest. And Jacqueline weighed in, an economy's purpose is to work for the people, not people working for the economy. So it does seem like this message, it could get some traction with people, Nancy, but how are we going to be able to tell if this is an actual shift or if this is just a different message that's being put out without much behind it?
We'll know pretty soon, right? For example, if I were Tim Cook, one of the 181 CEOs who signed this, the CEO of Apple, I go out there on the public stage in the next week and say, right, I'm going to raise wages, or I want to support a rise in the minimum wage, or here's what we have committed to in terms of environmental sustainability, and here's the hits we'll take in the short run to our bottom line in order to invest in environmental sustainability. What's so interesting about the comments that come through on Facebook and other ways from your listeners is these are people saying, wait a minute, for the long run, customers are employees. They need to make a living wage. In the long run, we have to have an environment that is sustainable. In the long run, we have to have decent relations that are stable in our communities. A lot of what has now gone as unquestioned wisdom in the business community about maximizing shareholder value is proving, in all these different ways we've discussed, to be ultimately fairly short-lived. So I think we're going to need to see from these CEOs quickly that their money is behind their mouths and that these folks are interested in the long game. And the long game includes a lot more people than just the folks that hold a lot of shares of stock in a company.
Well, Nancy, lots to talk about, lots to think about. Thanks so much for joining us today.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me, Judith.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School and author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. We talked with her about the Business Roundtable's new perspective on the purpose of corporations. They said that instead of just maximizing profit, they should be talking about other stakeholders, including customers, employees, suppliers, and local communities. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, healthy soil is important for growing nutritious food for humans and animals, for growing bioenergy crops and more. One of its hidden functions is capturing carbon from the atmosphere. We'll talk about soil's role in combating climate change. And the Trump administration is moving to end a long-standing court agreement that restricts how long U.S. officials can detain migrant children and their parents. We'll talk about with an immigration expert about what that might mean tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 6:30, for decades, families have flocked to their favorite county fair in Wisconsin. With more than 70 fairs to choose from, host Keely Boltino learns how county fairs have evolved in the state and the many ways that they teach area youth about agriculture. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then WW, the company better known as Weight Watchers, recently unveiled its newest weight loss app, which is geared towards children as young as 8 years old. We'll talk to a pediatrician about the app and how parents can talk with their kids about healthy body image. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.